Welcome to the Humanity Matters podcast, where we discuss and reflect on faith and philosophy, leadership and social issues. We want to engage in ideas and what it means to be a free human being in the pursuit of human flourishing. For more information, please visit our website, philipfletcher.org. And now, the Humanity Matters podcast. All righty, so welcome to part three of deontological ethics. And so we're going to do a review as we close out this portion of ethics and ethical theory, looking at not consequentialism, which focuses on outcomes like utilitarianism, but now we're looking at non-consequentialist thought. All right. That's where we can get into the realm of what we've been talking about, the categorical imperative with Kant. Next week, we'll be looking at virtue ethics and then looking at equality and discrimination. And so right now, we're in this realm of non-consequentialist type thought as it relates to ethics. But right now, in regards to deontological ethics, all right, one of the thoughts that we looked at and the practical application of it is when we, on Tuesday, looked at a speech given by former Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Back in 1962 as he was critiquing segregation. And he said this, and I'm quoting, "There must be a recognition of the sacredness of human personality. Deeply rooted in our political and religious heritage is the conviction that every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth." Pause. So, King is not only drawing from the United States Constitution, he's drawing from the Declaration of Independence, he's drawing from his religious thought, specifically Christianity, and he is locating that in the transcendent idea that every man is an heir, is a recipient of, is entitled to this recognition of dignity and worth. Where does he get that from? He draws on and he says this, and he's quoting Immanuel Kant, in which he goes on to say, Immanuel Kant said in one formulation of the categorical imperative that, quote, "all men must be treated as ends and never as mere means," close quote. Now, we're going to circle back around to that as we look at the weaknesses of the categorical imperative under deontological ethics. But nonetheless, some terms to pay attention to: deontology. It's a theory of duty, obligation, rights. All right? It's not focusing on the outcome, that what is right or wrong is depending on the outcome. That's utilitarianism. Rather, right or wrong is dependent on, this is my duty. And I follow my duty, it may set me apart, even if the outcome is difficult. Next thing is rooted in this idea of what is called stoicism. So it's an obedience to natural law, and duty is essential, even in the face of pain. So we're going to seek to do what is right, even if it sets me apart socially, if it sets me apart in relationship to a family, a religious group, or even the law of the land. So once again, we're drawing on what happened in the civil rights movement and in other cases related to social justice. The other things we talked about, hypothetical imperative. There's two different types of imperatives here. All right. The first, a conditional rule to secure create a conditional good. And so we've gone through some hypotheticals right? We looked at the trolley idea. We looked at the idea of seeing a tribe expose their elders to the elements in order to secure goods for the future generations. But the imperative would say, it's not the outcome that needs to be measured as being good, but is that essentially the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, which leads us to the alternative imperative, the categorical imperative, the fundamental ground of morality, the transcendent, the universal idea that is applicable to every man, woman, and child, regardless of time, space, culture. Right. And then we looked at different duties. There's perfect duties, your oughts and ought nots. You've heard them before. You ought to do this. You should not, you better not, you will not do this. Perfect duties. And then there are those imperfect duties, those things that are to be praised. Oh, Ashanti showed up to work or school or work on time. Marcus rehearsed hard and is showing on the stage. Now, so these rules are used to govern right or wrong action. Alright? So it's clear. It's like the Ten Commandments. When we use religion, it could be something that's been established in your home. So a deontologist would look at this and say, it is wrong to steal. It is wrong to kill. Respect your elders, regardless of the situation. So with utilitarianism, there was a cost-benefit analysis. We gotta look at the positive and the negative trade-offs. We go through that utilitarian calculation, right? What is going to produce the greatest amount of what? Happiness for the greatest number of individuals. Deontology doesn't consider that. So for the deontologist, looking at the trolley problem, what would the deontologist say? Would the deontologist push the fat man off of the bridge in order to save those on the trolley? What would he or she say about that action?
It's wrong.
It's wrong, right? In terms of theft, the deontologist would look at that and ascertain that, yes, you can go in and take said items from a grocery store in order to feed your children, but that action would be wrong. It would be wrong. Now, a review of the categorical imperative from Tuesday. Again, it's the universality of the moral law. The big thing is this, is that human beings are subjects, not objects. Human beings are ends in and of themselves. Human beings are not, Martin Luther King makes it even stronger, echoing Immanuel Kant, human beings are never to be a means to another human being in. Never. Now we'll critique King in a second. Is there ever an opportunity? Is there ever a situation in which one human being is to freely or even not freely be a means to the ends of another? See what I'm saying? So there's three considerations regarding ends. All right? Let's look at that. All right, we're going to jump down to the witnesses real quick. All right? There are times in which people are a means to an end. Can anybody think of one?
Can you repeat the question?
Sure. At what times are people used voluntarily or involuntarily? We'll say voluntarily first. Voluntarily, a means to another human being's end.
Okay, this kind of relate to that, but it was like a video of slavery, like when the slave master was trade the slave,
mm-hmm.
and it compared it to the NFL and how they got make a certain jump,
okay.
to be on a team.
Okay.
Led by the white people, something like that.
Okay. So you're talking about in the draft process,
yeah.
Correct? Okay. That the athlete has to do particular things, exercises for the team to determine whether or not that athlete would be a fit for the team?
Yeah.
Okay. What would be another consideration?
Any like emergency service type of thing?
Okay, let's hear it.
Like, just say if somebody is threatened, like with the last bullet point, somebody is threatened my existence,
mm-hmm.
one group of people that I could call would be the police, and they would have to come. They volunteer because that's the job they choose mm-hmm. to do. Mm-hmm. So they would have to come, mm-hmm. and you know.
Okay. Very good. Very good. So one of law enforcement, that law officer is a means to the end of your continued existence, right? By offering protection to you, right? I am a means to your end. Am I not? What is your end here? Well, specifically here.
Pass the class.
Pass the class, right? In order to pass this class, right, I possess a body of information and knowledge that you do not have, correct? And understand. But in order to pass the class, you need something from me. So I voluntarily place myself, now this is, I'm qualifying, voluntarily place myself to become a means to your end, correct? Think about our mothers. Are they not means to an end?
Yeah.
How else do we come into this world? But through our mothers, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And for a period of time, all right, they nurture us, correct? So in that familial situation, a parent is a means to a child's end. Now that child may not understand the end, but naturally that human body knows it's going to need physical, emotional, psychological support, right? And it's got to come from a stronger source, okay? So, three considerations we need to think about when we're talking about ends, and we're critiquing now what Martin Luther King said when he said, quoting Immanuel Kant, and I quote, Immanuel Kant said in one formulation of the categorical imperative that, quote, all men must be treated as ends and never as mere means. So there are times in which human beings will serve as means to another human being's ends, okay? Now, when we talk about ends, three different considerations. One, ends can be understood as influencing or dictating the will to pursue or avoid. So, for instance, each one of you in here has a goal to not just pass this class, but to do what? From Philander Smith University.
Graduate.
That is your end. And that end is motivating your will to show up here, not just in this class, but all your classes this semester and moving forward until you are conferred a what?
Graduation
date and a degree. That is your end. So that can be understood that way. The second way it can be understood is in terms of development, in terms of nurturing. That's what's happening in this class right now. I have an end that you would know something more about ethics than what you had before you came in this class, right? And you're gonna have it too. Now, it's not just, I need to take this class because it's on my degree plan. I need to take this class and pass it because I need to keep my GPA up. You should also have an end in it that I should grow in my understanding of determining what's right or wrong, good and evil, just and unjust, to apply it to whatever it is that you're going to do when you graduate from the university. But even when you walk out this door in a few minutes, and then you look at situations on campus differently, because I promise you, there will be something that happens on campus, because it's usually something that happens every year. Right, DeMarcus? Mm-hmm. Yeah, something that gets the university like, right? And what's going to happen is people are going to be on this side and the other side, right? And an ethical battle is going to be happening. Sorry. You have more?
I got a piece of gum.
No, those right there, man. The Smarties is everything. I'm not going to take this stuff. Back to the top. But all of that comes from your personal development, your nurturing. All right, and then finally, a third type of end, again, Travis alluded to it, referred to it, understood in terms of what could be detrimental to your existence or well-being. All right? Now, this is stuff you have to pay attention to because you may see it in the midterm. So, just like we have a utilitarian calculation, all right? We have steps in which we can determine, is this something to be followed? And again, and I referred to this on a Tuesday, this idea of this kingdom of ends. What can we establish, all right, in a ideal moral society in which individuals' personhood is protected, but then also the society is flourishing? So, some steps here. Excuse the spell check. Step one. Develop a maxim or principle which summarizes your proposed plan of action. So we'll draw on history, integration. Black men and white men should be able to associate with one another free of any type of government interference on the basis of race. Step two, restate the principle as a universal law of nature which governs all rational agents. In other words, all must act according to the natural law as you would act. So, in other words, let's restate what we just said in step one. Every human being has dignity and worth and is free to associate with one another. And that's applicable everywhere, whether it's in Montgomery, Alabama, Memphis, Mississippi, Los Angeles, California, the Bronx, New York, Jamaica, countries and nations in Africa. It's a universal law of nature. Every human being has dignity and worth. Step three. Now you need to put it to the test. Test if your principle is conceivable in a world governed by this new law of nature. Is it possible that this happened? I'm not forcing you to do this. We're simply stating that in this society, a kingdom of ends amongst rational individuals like myself and each one of you in this classroom, this could be something that could be realized on a daily basis. Now, that was echoed in the I Have a Dream speech that was celebrated 60 years, August 28th. Step four, ask yourself again, would you or could you rationally will to act on your principle in such a world governed by this new law of nature? If yes, the act is morally permissible. Could you will yourself to see another human being who is ethnically or racially different than you as a human being who has full dignity and worth? Even if that meant acknowledging their full dignity and worth brought about some level of pain to you, whether emotional or physical, psychological. Now, if you're able to answer these, if you fail step three, right? So if you test your principle, and it's not conceivable in a world governed by this new law of nature, all right? It becomes a perfect duty. It's conditional. If you make it all the way to step four, all right? So step three, you're like, dang, this is what we ought to do. Step four, if you cannot rationally will this to act on your own principle, then it's an imperfect duty. Now, if you're able to pass all four steps, it's a universal moral principle. All human beings should be treated as equals regardless of skin color. So this is the formula of the universal law of nature. Now, there can come some times when there's the weaknesses of the ontology again. Is it ever permissible to kill? Defense. Okay, talk about it.
Self-defense.
Self-defense. All right, how so? Let's get a little deeper.
You want an example? Mm-hmm. If I'm being robbed and they have a gun to my head, if I get a chance, at that moment, I'm going to kill them because my life is being threatened.
Okay. Anybody else want to add to that?
But like with self-defense, it can only go so far because some people can like take self-defense and run with it. Like, just say if you get in a street fight or something.
Okay.
And your life, it was a fight, but it could be a situation to where your life wasn't in any immediate danger. Mm-hmm. In your head, you think it's self-defense, so you beat him to death. It could have just been a street fight, and where somebody would have lost, everybody could have walked away from it. One person mm-hmm. could walk away from it.
So, okay. So, if I am able to walk away from it, right? Or maybe, I don't know what type of defense you are seeking to implement, DeMarcus. What the means of that defense is, right? Mm-hmm. All right, we can talk about that. But if we run this through these steps, let's talk about it. So, let's develop a principle which summarizes your proposed plan of action. So the proposed plan of action is to protect life in an instance of self-defense. Okay, so that's step one. So step two, somebody restate that as a universal law. So all human beings must act according to this natural law as you would act. So how would that be? How would I protect life while practicing self-defense? But it also has to be applicable to all rational people. Somebody restate. So you're just seeking to restate it another way.
You should be able to, a person should be able to defend themselves.
Okay.
If under attack or something like that.
Okay, all right. So a human being should be able to defend one's life while under attack. Mm-hmm. All right. We'll use positive. A human being should be able to protect one's life while under attack. Okay? All right. So, test if your principle is conceivable in a world governed by this new law of nature. So, DeMarcus is walking down the stairs. Travis is coming up the stairs. DeMarcus pushes Travis. Travis kind of falls down the stairs. Travis gets back up, pushes DeMarcus. And a fight ensues. Are both at that moment in a position of self-defense?
Well, at that moment, yes, but
where
Travis is defending himself because I pushed him first.
Yeah. Okay.
But once they start fighting, they both are defending themselves.
Okay. Some nuance in there, very good. Keep it going. Yeah, keep it. Because remember, we're testing this. So the maximum that has been laid out, that's being tested, is a human being should be able to protect one's life while
under attack.
Under attack, right. So is there any implied limitations?
No. Over a situation this small, no, but it really depends on the person.
Like, okay.
Just say Chuck is already in a bad mood, then DeMarcus kind of pushed him, and he take all his anger out on DeMarcus, and then he end up to DeMarcus dying.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, yeah, it just really depends on
the situation.
Yeah, the situation, how far the situation go, why they fight. Like, just say, let me see, Chuck pull DeMarcus' earring out. Without taking it out, like, but he's like ripping your ear. And then Mark go get mad, you know. What you gotta do? They gonna be doing what they gotta do.
Okay. So how would you act?
Me?
Yes.
If somebody ripped my ear?
Yes, Mr. Gibbs, how would you act?
He did. Or if something gonna happen to him. Or if something gonna happen to him too.
We both like,
so he can feel the same pain on you.
Okay. So Travis, how would you act? Because remember, all must act according to the natural law as you would act.
I don't think bumping somebody warrants you killing them.
No, he didn't push.
Okay, see, I don't
think. On the stairs.
I don't think.
The altercation is going on, so we've moved beyond the bump. Okay. Yep, go ahead.
I mean, Steve, I just fight him.
Okay.
If you beat me up, he beat me up.
Okay.
If I beat him up, I beat him up, then we're just gonna go on about our life.
Then we're just gonna go on about our lives. All right. So.
That's not gonna roll over like that.
Say again or something.
That wouldn't roll over like that.
How come it?
Like in my head, especially if I get beat up in public.
So key.
Like somebody gotta die.
So listen to what Miss Duncan said. She said in her head.
Like in my head.
Okay.
If I get beat up in public, you watch me. With your phone out, you recorded me getting beat up in public. All y'all up that video, and y'all putting that in your group chat, y'all send that to your friends, y'all mommy, y'all daddy, y'all send that everywhere. This ain't worldwide now. Somebody got a dad from that. Somebody got to pay. Somebody. Somebody. Somebody.
Okay. So then, what we're demonstrating here in this scenario is that it fails at step three.
Yep.
And so because it fails at step three is what is called a perfect duty. You ought to defend yourself, right? And not take life. You ought to. Or you ought not to take a life while defending oneself. We flipped it around. Okay? It's not universally applied because what you're demonstrating is each one of you are going to react like, well, this is what I'm going to do. I don't have the expectation that somebody else is going to act the same way, right? So just as in preparation, especially when we get to midterm time, all right, there'll be scenarios that you have to run this through and come up to whether or not it is a perfect duty, an imperfect duty, or does it pass all four steps to become a universal principle like what King was arguing for?
So what would you call it if it failed at step one, two?
You need to keep doing the work. Yeah. Keep doing the work. And that's why here it's restating here it fails, then I need to go back here again and keep restating. Keep doing that work. Is this what is to be universally applied as right or wrong? Miss Gibb.
Okay, I got an example. So, okay, cross country, like it's a lot of us. It's a lot of us on the line. It's a lot of teams consisting of like at least five people per team.
Okay.
So, and okay, we're running. And to place ourselves in a good position where we can have a good time, it's a lot of where I have been involved, it's a lot of pushing and shoving.
Yeah.
So what I did, our first meet, I got bumped, but like it went to where it threw me off. But like I just kept running, so I had to put myself in a good position. Somebody else probably would have pushed them back, but I feel like it could be a universal law because if they do too much, it'll lead to them being kicked off the team or putting a bad name out for the school.
Okay. So it could be established in cross-country competition, mm-hmm. if you will, universally, right, that when a race is commencing, right, it's a starting line, right, mm-hmm. that individuals make no physical contact with one another, right? And that is conceivable in a world governed by this law, right? Now, so right now we're good, right? Step four, ask yourself, would you or could you rationally will to act on your principle? Would you do that? Would you be able to do that? Would you be able to take off from the starting line and not elbow somebody, jockey for position, right? Knowing that rule, right? Yes. Right? It hits all four steps, it becomes a universal applied principle, right? Now, if someone chooses not to, right, knowing full well their duty, their obligation, their right, because they've been handed the rule book, right? They've practiced it, right? And then when it's time for competition, they know they have a moral obligation at the starting line when the gun goes off to run and not make physical contact with somebody. They have a moral obligation. And if they do otherwise, then there's penalties, right? Whatever those would be. So that's a very good example. So that is a good introduction into deontological ethics. Next week we'll be picking up with what is called virtue ethics. We'll be looking at Aristotle. Again, with this ethical framework, we're looking at what determines right or wrong is not on the basis of our outcomes, but is based off of some principles or some higher ideal or divine command that is said, do this, that is what justifies it as being right, or to do otherwise, that determines that it is wrong. For more understanding on deontological ethics and the categorical imperative, right, look at an Immanuel Kant, all right? Again, play it out. If you want examples of it, and this will help you, especially when you get to your final paper, if you choose to use the categorical imperative to interrogate the topic. There are great examples of the use and application of it in the civil rights movement. Also, feminist thought. We'll get to ethics of care as well. Martha Nussbaum will be doing that in a few weeks. Again, it's looking at, and hold this up, this universal moral principle. And then more specifically, how one human being relates to another human being. Are we relating to one another on the basis of personhood and subjectivity? Or are we relating to one another on the basis of objectivity? And if we're relating to one another on the basis of objectivity, meaning I am a means to your end, then we have to ask ourselves, am I a means to your end voluntarily, or are you constraining me to do so? And if you're constraining me to do so, in order for you to achieve your particular end, the question you need to ask yourself is, are you violating my personhood? Are you depersonalizing me? And to arrive at establishing a universal moral principle, state the principle, restate that principle to see if it's something that you would rationally do and others would do, put it to the test, and then finally see if this is a principle that can be universally applied across all boundaries, whether time, space, culture, families, religion. What are your questions? Good deal. I will see you on Tuesday. I will have your papers graded and returned. And also, the grades will be loaded up in JICS, so you'll at least see the grade. I'll have the comments on the papers ready for you on Tuesday. And be ready to discuss virtue ethics, so make sure you're going through your textbook and reviewing that. All right? Now, we'll see you on Tuesday.
Yes, sir.
Hey, if you found something of value, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Find us on Facebook at Dr. Philip Fletcher. Find us on Twitter at Phil Fletcher. And as always, visit us on the website philipfletcher.org.